Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of the show. Today I'm joined by Lucy Meir, who's a film producer and owner of Strive Films and currently on BFI Insight, which is a specific film producer program focused on rising talent in the field. Lucy, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me, and how are you doing?
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm very good, thank you. I'm a bit sweltering in the heat, but otherwise fine.
I know, it's that island tropical monsoon life that you get in England these days, right?
Yeah. I don't quite know that I figured out how to cope with it yet, but yeah, I'm adjusting.
Don't worry, it's going to rain again soon. It's what it does. So it'll just flip-flop down to like 10 Celsius in a day or two. You'll be good.
God, I'll be regretting that it's not hot anymore. I'm complaining about when it's hot and then when it's not.
Exactly. I think that's the way of the English sort of mindset, isn't it? One thing is never good enough and then you complain about the other thing. So look, obviously we were just talking a little bit there before we hit record about, you know, what lockdown's kind of been like for you. And you were sort of saying surprisingly busy. Do you want me to talk about that a little bit in terms of, I guess, what your expectation was and then, I guess, you know, how you've been occupied during the past however many months it's been?
Yeah, well, I when we were going into lockdown, I was maybe a month or so away from going into a shoot. So that massively affected that. And if there was no lockdown, I would have been concentrating on that full time. So I totally expected that actually I would have nothing to do. But instead it turned into a lot of conversations with other producers, you know, other people in different parts of the industry. And yeah, those first few weeks were just a lot of kind of Zoom conversations with everybody going, I don't know what's going on. Do you know what's going on? Do you know anything? So there was a lot of that kind of communal talking to other people and trying to get some insight from people about, you know, are people looking for projects? Are people not looking for projects? Are financiers still interesting? Should I be pitching? Should I not be pitching? So a lot of those conversations about, well, what is happening in the industry now? What do we think is going to happen in the next few weeks? And then that's kind of continued, having regular chats with people. But one of the things that I found that was quite surprising was a lot of doors were open that weren't before. So a lot of people that wouldn't normally get back to me or would maybe take a little while to get back to me on emails were getting back quite quick. I think because everybody's guard was down. Everybody's in the same position. Nobody knows what's going on. So yeah, a lot of sort of sales agents and financiers and actors agents in particular were quite keen because everybody wants to have something to go back to. So nobody knows how that's going to happen. So everybody's trying to get as much going as possible so that they can dive into it. You know, the actors whose big series or films have been postponed, they might have like a week over the summer to shoot something now, whereas they wouldn't before, and they want to be seen. Their agents want to be seen to be, you know, still working. The talent have got nothing to do. They're bored. They want things to read. They want to know that there's still an industry out there for them to go do. So yeah, it was surprising how productive it's been. And the other thing as well is that there's a lot of writers and directors who have had no choice but to sit at home, and they can either do nothing, which has been what some of them have had to do to adapt, whereas others have really, really dived into this time. There's some writers that I work with have been ringing me every day with a new idea that they want to develop. So it's been a good time to really nail down some development and get projects going, I think.
Yeah, I hear that. I don't think there's a right or wrong to that either in terms of how we use our time, obviously. But I think to your point, all the distractions that we normally have in sort of whatever normal life once was sort of dissipated. And then you're like, oh, well, okay, do I just watch Netflix all day? Or do I decide to be creative and find an outlet? Or like, you know, does it change from day to day? But yeah, I'm with you. There's this groundswell of people that have just come together across all facets of the industry. And yes, I think the best networking of many people's lives has happened in the past 3 or 4 months during a pandemic, which is kind of insane.
Yeah, it is. And it's strange how much of a leveler it is. Like some people that I couldn't normally get in the door with, and you have a meeting like you know, of a Zoom like this, and you're expecting like this really professional put together person, and it'd be really intimidating walking into their office, but then they pop up on screen and you can hear screaming kids in the background, they're under their stairs with a bad home haircut, and it's really humanizing to be like, oh, yeah, we're on the same page here.
Somewhere there's that dad from that BBC News interview when the kids ran in that went viral going, I told you this was normal. Like, I don't know why you're all freaking out at me.
That's it. That's all of us now. Exactly. That's all of our reality nowadays.
Exactly. Well, look, I guess before lockdown happened, obviously, you'd put in a good 6-7 years to build up to where you're at, to get Strive Films launched and obviously, you know, work on all these projects. But maybe you can, in your own words, talk a little bit about your sort of origin story of Lucy Meir. How did your superhero story as a producer, for lack of a term, come to pass?
Yes, so I will preface it by saying that I seem to have a bit of a luck gene.
You want to share that? You should patent it and just sell it.
I mean, part of it, especially the conversations going on at the moment about privilege, I've been very privileged in some senses. I am a working class person from the north of England. So, you know, London and the film industry never seemed like a reality to me, despite the fact that I've loved film my entire life. It's kind of been my safety blanket. But I went to university to study film. I went a little bit later, I was about 21. Mm-hmm. And in a total kind of turn of events that I couldn't predict or replicate, an established producer came to my city to produce a film and use the university as a base in exchange for taking on trainees. So I applied to be the producer's assistant. I got that role. I had no experience, and I'll be honest, when I had the first conversation with the producer, I could tell that she was very like, oh dear, she didn't think that was going to go well at all. However, from there, I worked with her very closely every single day throughout the production. She then kept me on to help with the post-production of the film, which was my first paid work in the industry, because I wasn't paid, unfortunately, to start with.
Funny how that works.
Yeah. I mean, I was a student at the time, so you're used to being skint and poor anyway.
It's your apprenticeship. Everybody needs that little kind of, you know, pay your dues kind of experience.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, you know, because it was at the university, I was already there anyway. But yeah, I stayed with her throughout post-production, and then she kept me with her company kind of in development, because a lot of what she was doing whilst producing that film, you know, whilst that filming was happening, she was putting together packages and developing other projects to go forward. So I'd already been doing that with her. So she kept me on for about a year or so. And then from there, I kind of wanted to reach out a little bit, knowing that this was my only real experience of working with this one producer. So there's a kind of company in England called Creative England.
Yep.
They did a scheme at the time called Producer Hot House, which was taking regional, sort of emerging regional producers and basically put them in established production companies. So I applied for that, not expecting to get it at all, and then I did. And I sort of, in a mutual decision with all of the different companies that were involved, I went to work at Warp Films, which was amazing because they were like gods to me when I was younger. I loved all of their films. I thought they were brilliant. And so it was a real dream come true to go and work with them for 6 months, and just the level of access that I got for being there. It was a paid opportunity.
That was in Sheffield, right?
Yes, so in Sheffield, which another reason, as again, as a northerner, I kind of didn't want to go down to London and sure. do that route. So them as a company really were like, this is what I want to be as a mm-hmm. producer. So I worked with them for 6 months. And then again, the luck gene comes into play that whilst I was there, they wanted to take on a short film for Sky in order to sort of get to know the commissioners better, which they wouldn't normally have done. They haven't done a short film for a long time. And because I was there, they were like, do you want to produce it? So I was like, yeah, yes, I do. So that was my first producing credit. And then from there, I left Warp. I set up Strive Films, did my first solo short film production, which was called Mary Anning, which went on to be BAFTA longlisted. And then, yeah, it's kind of just gone from there, really. Taken on projects, doing short films. I've got another short in post-production at the moment that's funded by the BFI, starring Stephen Graham.
Yeah.
And I've got two more short films in funded, well, they should have been going into production this year, but we'll see what happens there. And then a whole slate of film and TV projects that are at various stages. So yeah, it's kind of, I've grown into producing. I haven't necessarily come through the route of being a runner, production assistant, all of that. I'm incredibly lucky that I kind of skipped a few steps.
Sure.
But I kind of had to do it backwards, in a sense. I got all of this producing insight at a level that I was never going to be allowed to do in the first few years. So I'm still waiting to use a lot of the insight and knowledge and experience from that first year, you know, to get a feature off the ground and do all of that kind of stuff. So. Yeah,
it is that thing, I guess, of, you know, proving that you can do a few of your own projects that might be shorts or mini series or whatever that might be, the calling card, so that then you can get the funding for something bigger, whether it's a micro budget feature or something a bit more sizable budget wise. It used to be back in the day that people would say, you know, short films were the calling card. You should always do a short film. Then that kind of seemed to have a weird period where that disappeared and people were like, don't do short films, you're wasting your time. And now it sort of feels like that might be not back, but like it doesn't matter anymore because of the nature of different types of content. I don't know what your view on that is. I'm thinking more for someone starting out, maybe with a few credits, they want to get a few tentpole pieces before they can then go for the bigger funding piece. Are shorts the way to go? Is it a micro series? Is it a YouTube mini series? What's your view on the best approach?
It's obviously totally dependent on the person, but I think the most important thing for me is to think about where do you want to be and is this the best way to do it? I think short films serve a purpose if you're, you know, a really authored director. They're a really good way, you know, in the UK, the BFI are probably the only people putting real budgets behind short films. So if you want to be in that more art house independent landscape, you're probably going to have to do that, try and get things out on the festival circuit. However, there are some directors in particular who've never made a short film. They've gone through music video production, which is invaluable when it comes to the kind of technical skill, especially if you wanted to go into larger scale productions, because you're going to do things on music videos that you'll never do on a short film. So I think it's knowing the kind of creative that you want to be, and how you want to get that out there, working within the kind of UK independent sector and doing a short film through that. Or do you want to be a DOP on like Christopher Nolan films, which I know Roger Deakins does that most of the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're a DOP that wants to show off kind of skill in terms of really interesting, innovative ways to work, funded music videos are going to be a much better way to go, you know. And if you want to be in TV, again, sort of, it's a writer's medium. Are you a stronger writer or are you a stronger director? Do you have something to say? Are you a performer as well, like performing? Absolutely. In television, you can be a writer performer in a way that you can't really in film unless you're already a mega star. You know, some of the best TV at the moment is from writer performers, you know, Michaela Cole, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, all of these people, their personalities as well as writers. So yeah, there's a million different ways you can go. I think you just need to know what you want from it and how other people who want that same thing have approached it. Like, I think every decision, and I say this to a lot of kind of earlier stage producers and creatives, every decision and every project you do needs to be a stepping stone to another. Like, there is no point in you making like short film after short film after short film after short film if the process isn't changing, if it's not getting you somewhere different each time you do it, if you're not showing something different, because it's like the Einstein thing. If you do the same thing over and over again, it's just insanity.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Everything needs to be a stepping stone. Like, there is no point. If you've made 7 self-funded short films, your next stepping stone should be a funded short film.
Yeah, yeah. No, 100%. I think there's a difference between doing a short piece in a day that's just done for, you know, £2.50 and a pack of crisps, where it's you and a friend. But we're talking festival style films here, where you can maybe self-fund one or two, and then that's going to quickly become, unless you're like one of the Duplass brothers, very, very painful for your wallet, right? So I'm with you. There's got to be that, well, how do I then get funding? Or is the next thing a micro-budget feature? And how do you sort of scale up that way?
Exactly, exactly. You need to be very strategic with a lot of your decisions. It's such a competitive industry that you can't afford not to. Like, absolutely have fun and do things because you love them, but you can marry that up with it being a good stepping stone in your career as well.
And would you say that that's the same for genre as well, Lucy? Would you say someone, say they're, you know, more of a sort of comedic or mockumentary style writer or producer, should they focus mainly on that sort of content? Or is it okay to have a little bit of variety there?
I think you can have variety, but it's that kind of thing nowadays of how are you branding yourself? What you wouldn't want to happen is to do like a load of different things in different genres in different ways, and rather than it looking like you're versatile, instead it looks like you're confused about what you're good at and what you want to do. So yeah, like if you're a comedy person, there is no point you going to try and make a relationship drama. Like, it's just not going to showcase your skills. But you can absolutely work across different things, but a lot of the time people are going to ask you, what's your thing? And it's not necessarily, oh, I write comedy, but like for me personally, what attracts me to a film that makes me want to make something is characters that have a sense of otherness. They're quite cerebral or internal. I like things that lean into genre, but aren't full genre pieces. So knowing that about myself helps me assess the projects I want to do, how to get to where I need to be. There's no point me talking to like a really art house film distributor who's not interested in genre at all, because it's not going to be beneficial for either of us. So yeah, knowing the thing you're good at and how you can bring that into other things. Like, comedy obviously has a massive overlap with horror. Like, if you do comedy, absolutely try a horror, because it's all about timing. Like, those two things go together really well. So yeah, try new stuff, stretch yourself, but know why you're doing it, what the purpose of it is for. And there's no point throwing everything at the wall and hoping it sticks, because it very rarely works like that.
Yeah, that's just spaghetti slinging, right? And it doesn't apply in any walk of life. I think even you look at actors and you think, oh, well, they could do whatever they want, but that's complete fallacy. You think Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise played Tom Cruise for like most of his early career. Until he did like Vanilla Sky, or like Jim Carrey being the comedic guy, until he could eventually do Eternal Sunshine. So it's the same, I guess, on every side of the camera.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned there about knowing very clearly what that is for you. And my read on that is, this is very separate in some ways to film as the industry. Like, almost put that to one side for a second and go, who am I as a person? Like, did you have a moment where you were like, who am I as Lucy Meir? What do I like? What are my tastes? And really consciously, introspectively think about that? Or was it just organic that you always knew it in some way?
I think part of that is an intrinsic gut kind of, I know what I like. But it took a long time to really figure out exactly what that was. Like, but I think that the way that you kind of figure out that kind of thing is, well, what are the films that I gravitate towards? What are my top five? What are my top 10? And why are they in there? Which ones are the exceptions? Like, Tremors is one of my favorite films.
See, ever. I was just going to ask you to give me a top three or five, but it's fine. You gave me one of your top ones.
I love that film. However, as a filmmaker, it's not the film I'm going to make. Like, if I talk about kind of the producer I want to be and the things I would have loved to have made, I'm talking about things like Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin, like, beautifully cerebral. I would love to work with someone like Alex Garland. Like, I think he's brilliant. Very, you know, they're two very sci-fi examples. But then on the other hand, I absolutely loved Sicario. It was one of my favourite films. But the things that I found are commonalities across those films are, as well as having a lot of female protagonists, they're very singular introspective films. You know, Sicario is so much about the pressure that's on this one person and how she's having to deal with it. You're so with her throughout. The same Under the Skin is such an othered perspective on what it is to be a human being. Like, they all kind of deal in some sense of how do people relate to the world around them, and that I always find fascinating. And it can come across so many different ways in so many different genres, but it's the thing that drives me on all of the films I absolutely love. Like, that is the thing that when I look at it and I really, really think about the things I love, that's the thread across all of them, across genre, across writer, across performance, across character. That's what I gravitate towards. So naturally, when I want to produce something, I want to be as passionate as I want, like I can be about it. So I know that I can be passionate about that. I know I can identify it. I know I can find it in my projects. And that's what I find really interesting. So I want to make those things. Why not? You know,
absolutely. Yeah. I think it's having that self-awareness of knowing that and then coming into the work, as opposed to trying to find yourself through the work in of itself, which can get confusing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does happen simultaneously. You know, I don't think I could articulate it a few years ago, but I knew something about it. Like, that's when I look back at some of the projects that I took on, that kind of explains why they resonated with me. I maybe didn't know it at the time, but as a producer, you have to do a lot of that kind of, when you're trying to apply for funding or get money, you kind of have to make your film before you've made it and explain all of this. So knowing it, you're better able to articulate it over time, but it's something you absolutely have to do as a filmmaker. Like, you need to know why you're doing things, because that's what people are going to ask you before they give you money. Like, why?
That's a good segue. Let's shift into that side of the producer world, which is, I think, the side that most people probably, or a lot of people, would associate producers with the most, which obviously isn't the full story. We'll get the full story by the end of this, but funding and the money is obviously a huge element. So there's a lot to unpack there. I don't know where we start. I guess it's one of those where a lot of people, I think, they might have a fear of being the person to go and ask for the money as well for anything in life. So let's start with that. Like, for you, was that a barrier at all? How did you navigate that aspect of, okay, I've got to go and ask for money, pitch for this project? Was there a mindset kind of thing you had to get around?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, part of that is personally me. I'm a very frugal person. I love a bargain. So the thought of asking somebody for money is just like, don't do that, like, at all. But I think the biggest thing as somebody who's asking for money is knowing what you want that money for and why somebody would give it to you. So somewhere like the BFI, I feel a lot better about approaching them because that money is freely given, in the sense that that is what it is there for. Yeah. They want to support talent. They want to bring you up. They're saying, come to us, we've got some money. But beyond that, you know, getting more into the industry, it's getting your head around the idea that you're not just asking somebody to give you money out of the goodness of their heart. Like, that's not how it works. It's a business. And when you start to think about it as a business, it's not just, here's this lovely person that wants to give me like £100,000 to make a micro budget film. It's, here's somebody who expects something in return. And I need to, it's my obligation, it's my responsibility to do that. So whatever that is, you know, if you're making a commercial film, the expectation is that person's going to make their money back. However, if you're making an art house film, it's, so beyond the money, what does that person get out of that? Like, everybody wants to be associated with the next biggest talent. They want to be funding the thing that everybody loves. They want the critical acclaim. So have I got talent that I can bring to them that makes them go, I love the person you're working with, I'd like to give you money? Am I doing something new and interesting that might change their perception of the market? Like, am I telling a story that's not been told before? Do I have a perspective that isn't being explored that might be really interesting? Obviously, at the moment, things with a female focus are selling very well because it's really fresh and it's really new. We've had decades of never seeing what, like, women are actually like on screen. That's why Fleabag is such a phenomenon. And it's the same in film. Like, everybody's seen the same stories over and over again. So what's a fresh perspective on that? It's why women in horror are making a huge comeback at the minute. It's why horror's so interesting right now, because it's got all of these similar tropes about, like, you know, body horror. But when you see that from a female perspective, that's very different. That's very interesting. So I can do something new that somebody with some money can go, I want to be the person that can be associated with that. I might not make my money back on it, but I'm going to make, like, some real connections when I say I funded that, I made that, you know. So yeah, it's all about what can that person get for the money? What are they willing to give? Are they somebody who's given money before? Or, like, there's all these things that kind of go into it. And there's a million ways to fund a film. Everyone is different, but it's kind of like the last question. You need to know what it is you're making and what you're offering to somebody. Like, doing it for the passion and the love of the film is absolutely what you should be doing, but you need to marry that up with what other people want as well. And if you can, that's what a good producer does, I think.
Yeah, you loving your film is a no-brainer, but just because you love it doesn't mean everybody else is going to have the same level of attachment to it, which is the same as, you know, not everybody thinks your baby is the cutest baby in the world. Sorry to parents out there, but I think it's the truth. I'm going to get hate mail for that. But what's super interesting about what you said is, I think on a surface level, many people would look at it from a pure play business perspective and simply think, like, if I go to just entrepreneurship outside of film, okay, cool. You give me money in return, you are, as you said, expecting either money back or, you know, a percentage of the company. And it's very much, that's the mentality that's always been there. But I think it's great that you elaborate on that as being, well, it's not just about the money if that's not realistic, which isn't always the case. It's about, you know, are they buying into the vision, or is there a longer play there where they're going to, you know, either on an IMDb page because of it, they got a credit, they could say that they helped, you know, unearth this new star. And I think that then makes you look at, I guess, what's the story of what you're trying to promote? And even, like, what is the story of your film too? Maybe someone relates to the actual theme and they buy into that. So how, I guess that's one of the first things you do then, when you get a script and you're working with somebody, maybe you can go through a bit of your process, sort of how does that look in terms of formulating that pitch?
It totally depends on the project. Again, there's a million different ways to answer that. But it depends on the project and who's already involved. So if it's a new writer director that I've not really worked with before, I'm going to be going off of the strength of their potential and what it is they've brought to me. So what is on the page in the script, what is interesting about that script? For instance, Pop, which is the short film that I'm finishing at the moment, the thing that really interested me about that is it's a very familiar story in terms of kind of young masculinity in an ex-mining town. It's a very working class story. However, it's from the perspective of a young trans boy who's trying to figure out his identity. This is a different take. And it's also that it's present day, the kind of masculinity and identity that was around those kind of characters in the 80s and the 90s is very different now. So that's the kind of thing that attracted me to it. And I was really interested in the story. The director wasn't immensely experienced, but I thought what they put on the page was really good. And if they could direct as well as they could write, you're on to a winner. And luckily the BFI agreed and so put some money into it. And, you know, some other people, other individuals put money into it as well, which is brilliant. However, there's other occasions where there might be part of the reason that I take a project on is because of the people that are involved in it already. Like, I might not have seen what they want to do, but I know that they're really interesting filmmakers. I know that the industry really likes them as well. Like, I have to think about what the marketplace likes. So if there is a director that is coming up at the moment that is getting a lot of attention, and it so happens that the kind of films they make align with what I like, I'll go after them. I'll try and poach them from whoever they're working with at the moment. But in a nicer way than that.
Of course.
I'm trying to find those people who have, you know, the there's a lot of interest in them regardless of what they make. But if I can find the right thing and our skill sets match, then we're going to do that together. So yeah, it kind of depends. With pop, I'm pitching the story, why that's important. And then I'm pitching the director to BFI because she's a talent that they want to nurture. However, there's other projects where I'm saying, this is somebody that everybody in the industry is really interested in. And they want to make a story that I've got a track record and been able to deliver. So this could be really exciting for you. And now here's the story. And now here's how we're going to do it. What's going to be different? All of that kind of stuff. So knowing the strengths of each thing is super important. And then in terms of pitching it to people, it's who's already interested. So again, there's no point me taking like a genre horror action film to Curzon. They don't make those things. But XYZ do. They put money into those kind of things. And that has a bigger international market. You know, they make films that are very much for an American audience, as much as they are international. And that's where that project might sit. So yeah, then when you're pitching it, it's making sure that you're pitching it to the right people, knowing that somebody has a certain taste or likes a certain character, and catering to your to them, because they are a proxy for the wider market, essentially. Like the people that are going to watch your film at home, you need to think about what they would like, how would you pitch it to them, and then the person you're pitching it to is a proxy for them, essentially, because they can get you to that market, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And pitching is, I think, a big part of this whole game of how do you pitch, what does that look like, what do you need materials wise does that vary from project to project? Mm-hmm. I remember, so it's going back 6-7 years, talking to a big production company in LA, and they said, you know, you give me a feature film and a log line as the pitch, that's all I need sometimes to know if it's going to fly or not, and then we can get the wheels in motion. Mm-hmm. At the time when miniseries and sort of TV series were still big, but not maybe as commonplace as they were now, they were like, you can't just give me a log line or a treatment. I probably need like some form of series Bible, or maybe even the scripts for every episode, or at least a pilot. So it'd be good to get your view on that, maybe now 2020, in terms of, you know, I know it will vary from project to project, obviously, but pitching wise, how do people approach that? Say I'm a newbie coming into this and I'm bricking it because I'm like, I got a project, but I don't know how to pitch to like Channel 4 or Sky or whoever. Like, how can they, what should they do? What's the main things to focus on?
I think regardless of what you have on paper, what materials you have, you need to know your story in and out. Again, why you are the person to tell it and why now is the time to tell it. Those are two really good questions to ask yourself. Why you, why now? Ridiculously important, because you can't make all the rest of those materials until you know that. But then, yeah, I think it's just a case of having as much as possible. What you're doing when you're pitching is mitigating risk for the person who's going to get involved. So the safer you can make them feel, the better. That's not necessarily the more you have. So you might not want to go to Channel 4 with a full outline, a script for every single series. That doesn't work. But they at least want a pilot, a treatment, an idea of where that series is going to go, and maybe the characters. Like, you need to have that down, and it needs to match what you're telling them. So when you're pitching it to them, it needs to match what they then read, because you'd be surprised how often somebody tells you about their film and then what's on paper is not what they've just told you. And obviously that is, TV is quite different. They're very interested in what is on the page. Whereas film, because it can be a lot more authored, and everybody responds differently, absolutely knowing your log line and your synopsis are really important. Your synopsis really needs to encapsulate what your film is and how somebody should feel about it. But beyond that, like, if you have a script, brilliant. If you don't, a treatment at least. And the thing that happens a lot more in film than it does in TV is those kind of glossy pitch decks. Especially if you're playing with a concept that's not been done too much before, or you're working with a structure that's not too familiar, or new characters, you need to get across to whoever's reading that exactly how they should feel. when they've watched the film, essentially. It's like making the film before you've made it, annoyingly. Like, if you have a film that is really energetic and fun, and maybe it's violent, like, your pitch deck needs to be frenetic. It needs to not necessarily be colourful, but it needs to really jump off the page. Whereas if you're making a really painterly composed, poised portrait of a lady on fire, it's kind of that simplicity element that you want. It needs to be clear, concise. Like, the idea is that somebody reads that, looks at your deck, and gets the feeling innately in their gut that they would get watching your film. That's what you want to try and create. And there's every creative does it differently. Some people I know will put a really amazing sizzle reel together, especially if it is more energetic, and that is a really good selling tool. Whereas other people will, they'll put more emphasis on their kind of personal statement. Like, if you're a director who genuinely can say, I've never seen something like this before, maybe you want to put a bit more emphasis on who you are. So if, you know, Yorgos Lanthimos, for instance, you can't really quantify what his films are. Like, you need to know what kind of creative he is and what's driving him and where this is coming from. Because you could read one of his scripts, like, for a film that he's making, and be like, I have no idea how he's going to translate that onto screen. Like, not a clue what that's going to look like. I couldn't... The script for The Lobster does not convey what those performances are going to be like, the kind of stilted way that they speak. Like, so having a director's statement that really emphasizes it, like how you're going to put that across, is probably going to be really, really important for something like that. So again, it's coming back to knowing what your strengths are, knowing what makes you different, addressing weaknesses. Again, structure can be quite interesting. Like, if you're doing a film that's in two acts, you really want to emphasize that you know that it's a film in two acts, and this is why it works as a film in two acts. This is why we're doing that. It's a strength, not a weakness.
Or a mistake, or an oversight, that if you don't call it out, they're like, what's going on with the script here?
Yes, exactly. So if it is something that could be a barrier, you want to show that you're addressing it already. Like, you don't want to just point out that, oh, and this needs work, and we're not too happy with that. But yeah, if you're doing something a little bit different, make it the unique selling point. If you're a first-time director, like, that should be a unique, exciting thing. It should be, this is somebody who's going to burst onto the scene, and they're going to be amazing, and you're going to be in there right at the beginning. Like, that's a really exciting thing for some people. Like, yeah, they're maybe an untrusted director, but again, the director's statement, if you can really understand what it is that you're doing and why you're doing it, and convey that to somebody, magic. I love it.
And for you as the producer, I guess, ultimately, you know, you're looking to find those relationships, not just for one project, but for a career in a lifetime, right? You're looking for the writers and the directors to collaborate with or poach, so that you can do, you know, a short and then a feature, and then work with them on multiple things over time. Beyond that, I guess, how else do you, as Lucy and Strive Films, look to cultivate your work beyond the context that you have? Is it trying to find those exciting new talents out there? Is it going to agents who have, you know, people that are growing and sort of trying to get in with them? Or, you know, that's an interesting one. How do you get attached to projects beyond hustling?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little of everything. So I think a big thing at the moment as a producer is that I need to be generating IP for talent. So there's a lot of really good talent that I don't have access to at the moment, at least to have a general chat with, to see if we connect. However, if I've optioned a book or an article or have a concept that really aligns with them, that might potentially open the door to them. So that's kind of me at the moment. Access is what I need. I need to get to those people that are rising stars, that are going to, you know, I can build their work up and work with them, and we, you know, we rise together. But I can't always get to them because everybody wants them. So if I know that they're interested in something and I've got IP that works for them, that's brilliant. And it's a really good selling point anyway to have established IP. Again, it mitigates that risk of somebody coming on board. But yeah, it's that, to try and get to talent. I do a lot of talent tracking. So talent that maybe are on their first or second shot that I'm not in a position to take on their shot because I'm looking purely at features. But a few years down the line, they might be really interesting people to work with. So I kind of bide my time, or I might have a general chat with them. I do a lot of just talking to talent, because there might not be a project we can work together on now, but that's not to say that there isn't one in a year, 5 years, 10 years. So yeah, it's just a lot of that kind of conversation. And there's also talking to a lot of other producers. I'm a big advocate of co-producing. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult thing to do on your own. So there might be producers working with talent that maybe their stories aren't the thing that totally drives me, but they've got that relationship and I can co-produce something with them that helps me, you know, it helps me make a brilliant film that maybe I don't have the exact thing that talent is looking for. And I can work with another producer to help them and sort of ease the load of what they're doing. It opens a lot more doors for me. So those are the kind of, for me at the moment, those are the things that I try and do. But yeah, again, there's a million ways to do it, sure. Really.
But it's smart because you're playing the long game, which obviously this thing is, because you're doing it out of passion, but also practicality when it comes to having a career and making a living. And that doesn't just happen overnight, obviously, as much as people think it does. And I guess the importance of having a slate, which is always been a big thing, but it is that question that always comes, which is, cool, you've just done this. What else have you got? Love it. Okay, and what else? And what else? Like, you need to have, I mean, do you say there's sort of a magic number of how many things you'd recommend people have there on that development slate always in the background, or at least one?
I think as a producer, you need more than one. Like, you can't just have one. And a lot of that is going to depend on the time you have. You know, I'm in a position to do this full time. So I think anywhere between 6 to 12 projects that can be at various stage, I think you should always have something that is ready to finance. I know it obviously takes a bit of time to build up to that, but you should always be trying in that moment to get money for something that's going to be made in the next year or so, to keep momentum, keep profile, and to get, you know, paid. So you always need to be doing that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you've got 12 projects that you're giving like the same amount of time to all the time either. So some of those projects are, there's one project of mine I've got working with the writer director. It is literally just a concept. We had a chat about it, like, this is the film she wants to make, and in between other projects she's, you know, she's researching, she's going to start putting things together, but I'm already having conversations with people about that. So that's really early stage. Like, that's going to be a long time before that gets made. Whereas those are the ones that are a lot further along. And the thing is as well, especially when you're pitching, you'd be amazed how often the thing that you think is gold is not what somebody else is interested in. And the thing that you have a throwaway about like that, like, oh, I'm making a film about this, and people go, ooh, that's interesting, and you're like, oh, okay, let's talk about that then. So having that variety to pull things out of your pocket, you need to. The worst thing you could do is walk into a room and then be like, okay, that's interesting, but we've got something like that, what else have you got? And you go, nothing. Stops the conversation dead. So yeah, you always want a couple of things on the go at the same time.
And I guess also when you strike hot with something which you can't predict, you then don't want that to sort of, that momentum to just go nowhere because you have nothing to follow up with it, right? Like, you know, you get a film that is well at a festival circuit, but then you're 3 years out from being able to even put the next thing into the world. That's, missed opportunities. So here's kind of a totally slightly different question, which would be around producing and any misconceptions that you think people have. Do you think, like, there's one big misconception that's out there about what it is that you actually do? By the smile on your face, there might be more than one. But what's, like, maybe the big thing that people look at and just don't get? And what's the truth of what you actually do comparatively?
I think there is a massive misconception, particularly for people who are new to the industry, that, for one, producers have money. I have no money.
You're frugal. You said it already. That's out there. You're frugal.
But yeah, the idea that I have money to just kind of go, okay, I love your project, let's go, that doesn't happen. And also that you're there as a barrier. I think there's potentially this perception when people look at kind of big studio films of, oh, the producers decided something different. The producers have no sense. They didn't know. But I think at least in the independent sector, your producer is your champion. Your producer is the one who is fighting for you all of the time. They're the person who's your cheerleader. They're going to tell everyone how amazing you are. They're going out and getting you some money. They might tell you to your face that maybe what you're doing isn't totally right, but they'll never say that to somebody else. So, yeah, I think there's this perception that producers are kind of money people and they're there to say no, that they were going, they're trying to limit you. But in my experience in the independent landscape in the UK, that's totally the opposite. I think producers are incredibly passionate people. They wouldn't be doing it if they're not, because more often than not, they're not getting the credit. So when your film blows up and you're the next, like, Francis Lee or, you know, Steve McQueen, I don't think there's a lot of film fans who are not in the industry who could tell me who produced their films.
Yeah.
And then they go off onto the next thing with more money, and the producer doesn't always go with them. So, yeah, I think the perception that we're not here for the craft and the love of it, because we absolutely are. It's just that in order to survive, we do sometimes have to think a little bit more pragmatically about what we're doing. You know, there's projects that I've loved that I've kind of had to let go because there's no place for them in the market. Maybe there is in 10 years, but there isn't at the minute. But I think somebody saying no to something is never like a power play. There's always a reason for it. So yeah, like, we're nice people. We like, we want you to do well. Producers want the best. But there's maybe a perception that we don't. So hopefully that might change what.
Yeah, I think it's just the Hollywood paradigm that people have in their mind. And maybe they've seen, you know, shows like Entourage or whatever, and they think that that's what a producer and that's what an agent's like. And there is a percentage, I'm sure, that are like that there. But. And then you have Harvey Weinstein messing it up for everybody. I think, you know, that's the problem. At the sort of peak level, that's the perception. And people are like, wow, that's a producer. Like, well, I don't know about that. I hope not.
Yeah, I can say I am definitely not in anywhere near the vein of a Harvey Weinstein producer.
I'm glad we got the disclaimer out there. Thanks, Lucy.
But also, I think that is maybe a preconception that people don't know, that I think the culture of film is changing. When he came up in the 90s, I think there was a lot more of the shouty, aggressive, like, very stressful environment. I think in the UK, like, it's still incredibly stressful and tempers flare at times, but there's a more, like, maybe in general there is a slightly more caring attitude to that. Like, people don't want, they're not shouty, they're not possessive, they're not controlling, as far as I can tell. Like, I've never experienced that. But I know a lot of people that came up in the 90s and the 2000s that have. Yeah. So yeah, I think even that perception of the industry itself is changing, I hope.
Yeah. How much of that do you think has to do with the fact that, you know, you go back 10, 15 years and there was a much more concise sort of, almost I'd say, controlling aspect to who the networks and studios were? Indie films obviously were coming out, but you know, you didn't hear that much of sort of the groundswell. And now with technology, it's easier to make the film just tech-wise, but also the platforms that we have make it easier to maybe shout about them. Mm-hmm. How much of that shift technologically do you feel has maybe helped level the playing field a bit more compared to going back a couple of decades?
I think it has, in the sense that, you know, it's still a very elite industry. It's still very closed off to the rest of the world, but the level of insight you can get now into how the industry works is just completely different. Like, even when I was, like, young, I couldn't find scripts for things. Like, I couldn't find interviews with a lot of people, whereas now a lot of that is readily available, and there's a lot of people who are putting their money where their mouth is and really opening up that industry. They're talking about the kind of things that they go through, how difficult it is. They're offering outreach. So I think there's so much more information out there on how to work. It's just that there's a lot more to wade through as well. So,
but that, like, again goes back to then knowing you and your story and your truth, and then you kind of take a bit from everywhere and figure out what works to throw the rest away and just move forward.
Yeah, Exactly. Like, there are articles that I've read that I'm just kind of like, this person has no idea how this industry works whatsoever, but somebody outside of it doesn't know that. So I think, yeah, it's, and I think part of it as well is you have a much better chance now to kind of cultivate a buzz around yourself and your work. Like, you can really reach audiences in a way that you couldn't before. You can get people interested. You'll hear names more often. You know, there are certain names in the industry that I see every single day. I can't remember the last time I saw any of their work on screen, but I see their names all of the time. Some people have a presence online that, like, totally outstrips their presence potentially in the industry. Like, you can build a real brand around yourself that I know that's very marketing speak, and I'm not always fond of that, but knowing what your niche is, you can get that out to people and they can respond to it. You have a more direct line to your audience that you never had before. Like, it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it. I think you can say, well, I know that there's people who want this, I'm not just going to make it and hope they come see it. I know they're going to come see it because they told me.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily, you know, have to have the millions and millions of viewers as an audience. It's on a micro level, you can do what the studios do, but at least that's open to you to then build that fan base and get that groundswell. And also, I guess, know who they are so that you've got the data to then say, well, these are the demos that align with my work. So then when you go to a distributor or you pitch your next project, you've kind of got something to back it up with, as opposed to, hi, I'm a filmmaker, love me for me and make my film, which is important, but what can you back it up with? I know the marketing thing is obviously a bit of a maybe dirty word for creatives, and we do have that kind of chip on our shoulder with it. But on the flip side, I guess as a producer, you have to have that mindset on there, because there's no point just making the film if nobody's going to see it, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. And I think there's this idea that marketing and branding yourself is this initially, and it makes me feel a bit, because it sounds like you're trying to sell something that you're not. You know, like, that's what I think of when somebody says, what's your brand? I'm like, what's a magical thing that I've just conjured to sell you something? Like, it's not. But again, it goes back to being that kind of self-aware of, you need to know who you are and what you want to make and why you want to make it in order for other people to know that. So if you don't know it yourself, you can't put that out there for them people to understand. And like I said, the last thing you want is somebody to go, but I don't really know what it is that you do. So whether somebody over there, I know what I'm going to get from them, like, or I have an idea of who they are and I'm excited to see what they're going to do. So it's not so much, let me sell you who I am, but I know who I am and I can put that out into the world so that the other people who want that can find me. And it's maybe just a kind of different way to think about.
Yeah. Branding. It's more being authentic as opposed to being a salesperson where you're trying to, you know, pawn off some soap or a watch to somebody. It's not quite that.
And no, you're not manufacturing an idea of who you are. You're just telling people who you are.
Hopefully. And when it comes to, I guess, marketing of a film in of itself, do you feel that a lot of times that gets overlooked by people, especially when it comes to allocation of budget? Or do you feel like there is, especially on the indies, do you feel like there is enough a portion to, you know, what we're going to do to then actually promote that and get it out there into the world? Because I'm curious about that side of things as well.
It's not an area that I have too much experience with, and generally in your film, I'm happy to pass over to a distributor. They know who it is, especially if you're working like with a more niche distributor who know their audience. But I often see that kind of criticism of, well, this film would have done so much better if so and so put more money behind it. But there's so many other factors into why that doesn't happen, like, not just on the return on investment in terms of getting to your audience. Maybe your audience isn't as big as you think it is, but also as a producer in an indie film, the bigger the spend on marketing, the longer it's going to take for my investors to get their money back. So and if they don't get their money back, they don't invest in more films. So there is a kind of limit on how far you can take things, and sometimes that, unfortunately, the money that gets put behind promoting and marketing a film isn't always to do with just the film. Like, I think, for instance, if you look at something like Moonlight versus Waves, same distributor, A24, probably a big crossover audience, the big difference between those two films is that Brad Pitt execs one of them. So like, it's not just throwing money behind it, it's knowing that that money has value because the person behind it throws their weight around the Oscars. They have the connections. It's not just throwing money into the void to push it and put posters on every single street. It's putting money behind something for a very, very specific reason because you know there's a return on that. Unfortunately. I'd love it. I think absolutely throwing money at things to get it wider is important, but there's sometimes a reason why that's not.
Yeah, I don't think it's throwing that money, is it? It's more targeted on, you know, knowing who your audience might be and then going after those specific niches and then seeing what comes back, as opposed to, again, spaghetti slinging. And, you know, not everybody has Brad Pitt on their team to do the politicking behind the scenes either. Not yet. Maybe in 10 years we can follow up. And when Brad's, you know, retiring from Plan B, he can roll you in to take over.
That's what I'm hoping my trajectory
is. There we go. That's the dream. Why not? Awesome. Cool. I guess final few little bits. One would be for you, what's like one of your biggest bugbears about the job? Like, what's something that you'd love, or maybe not the job, but just the industry? What's something that you'd love to sort of get a solution to that's not there at the moment, if anything?
For me, it's access to the industry. Telling you my story, I'm incredibly lucky that I was in the right place in the right time. Like, not to discount my own hard work, that wouldn't have gone any further if I didn't work hard for it, but I couldn't manufacture that opportunity again. And if I'd have not got that opportunity, I don't know what I would be doing right now. So I think, yeah, the biggest thing for me is it's still an incredibly closed off industry, and it's still an incredibly relationship focused industry. And there are obviously reasons for that. It's an incredibly subjective business to be in. You know, you haven't got a thing that serves a specific purpose and you're going to make money from it. So they all have their reasons. But I think, yeah, as a working class person from the regions, I really think that there needs to be a change in the industry on how we attract talent. Particularly in the UK, it's a really frustrating place to be in, that there is a lot of kind of gatekeeping and expected handholding for talent who then get frustrated that things move so slow. So they go to America where things move faster and people put more money in.
Yeah. And it's palpable. And you can feel it. I mean, the difference is night and day, at least in the major US markets. You go to LA and people are more willing to take a chance on a unknown or less established person, or at least have the meeting and hear them out. And here that's happening a little more. It has opened up, I think, but to your point, it still feels like it's, you got to work so hard to just get into the club. Mm-hmm. And then when you're in the club, that's when like there's another level of work you have to do to prove that you can even be worthy of staying.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's this kind of idea that the industry is gamified, that you can move up a level and then up a level and then up a level. And I think that is maybe perpetuated by certain institutions or producers or certain people, where it's kind of like, oh, well, once you've written your script, I'll have a look at it. But then you go back with the script and go, yeah, but once you've got somebody else involved, I'll have a look at it. Or as a producer, it's going to like a sales agent and they go, oh, well, once you cast Brad Pitt, we'll have a look at it. And you're like,
yeah.
Like, that's the boss fight on this level. Like, that's not going to happen.
It's that, get me Idris Elba. It's like, Idris Elba is not free for the next 5 years, and he won't do a £1 million feature that easily. It's got to be shit hot, probably. So,
yeah, exactly. And I think all of that kind of, that excludes so many people from the industry. And it's something that I'm really trying to cultivate with the people that I work with, and a lot of what I'm doing in the industry, you know, outside of producing films, is about offering opportunities to other people. I do a lot of mentoring. Like, you know, I've recently really tried to reach out with my circle. You know, my circle is very kind of white, working class, northern, and, you know, working more with people from different ethnic minorities who have very different struggles to me, but we can commiserate about the fact that it's really hard. So I think, you know, I wish this industry did a little bit more of looking outside of itself for new interesting talent, because so often all somebody needs is an opportunity. And they can run with it and do brilliant things. Like, I wouldn't be where I am without somebody taking a chance and giving me that opportunity. So I wish there was a lot more giving back in that sense, rather than pulling up the ladder behind you. I think you know, it's, we need to help other people to get access. And I really believe that that kind of rising tide lifts all ships. If we open this up a little bit, imagine how many Michaela Coles we've missed who haven't had the opportunity, who have something really important to say, but don't have the connections or the industry insight. Like, where is that person now and what are they doing and why aren't we trying to find them? Like, that's what we should be doing. And that's what I like to do, you know, I try and find those people whilst also trying to make it work within the industry as it is as well. You know, it's quite tough.
Juggling many hats, but I do think you're right. It's about sending the ladder back down, not pulling it up away from people, which, you know, there's that scarcity mentality that, you know, has no place really, because stories are endless and timeless. And I don't think there's a finite cap on how many people have or the ones we can tell. So, you know, we want to hear all of them and different ones and different voices. And the authenticity of a story for someone from a certain part of the world is going to be authentic if it's written by and produced maybe by those people. You know, I always say, I take the Bronx as a random example. I don't know why, but like, I couldn't write about the Bronx. I've not fucking lived there.
Yeah.
I mean, I could, but it's going to be a very sort of caricatured perspective of what I think it is, as opposed to, you know, get me someone who's lived in the Bronx and actually lived and breathed it and can write about that authentically, because that then translates onto screen. And I think, you know, there's so many different people in the world that don't get that platform at all. And then when you get it, it's so refreshing. Like, look at Parasite.
Ugh.
And you're like, okay, that's a guy who's done so much work anyway in South Korea. It's not his first rodeo. But people lost their shit because it was such a refreshing take to the mainstream, at least. And you're like, well, hello. You know, go outside of Hollywood or the Western market. There's a lot there.
Well, even within it, like an example I always use to kind of show the difference between potentially the British independent industry in America is somebody like Ari Aster. So he'd obviously been trusted with bigger budgets, but nobody in the British film industry, no matter how experienced you are, nobody gets a first feature with a budget of Hereditary. That doesn't happen. They don't get it pushed as much. Like, you know, I've worked on films that have had really famous people direct them as a debut, and they've not had that kind of push. Like, he wouldn't have been given that opportunity if he was in the UK, I don't think. And look what he did with that. I'm still blown away by the fact that that is his debut. And I've gone back and watched his shorts. He's a really good short filmmaker, but they're not necessarily, you can't see that, oh, well, clearly Hereditary was going to happen. It's just, it's a brilliant, brilliant, amazing film. And I'm blown away that that is his debut director. And somebody took a chance to really put some money in there. They got Toni Collette involved. Like, that to me is just, look what happens when you give somebody a chance. Like, and that's somebody who's been working for years and years and years and years and years, has so much experience. Like, we need to start doing that at a grassroots level to get people up to be able to take on those first features and blow people away.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I guess it's not just basing their ability on a feature with what they've done on a short, because a short is a different animal in every sense of the word, right? I mean, do you feel like people that take shorts as that calling card for a feature is maybe a route for someone getting into it? I'm thinking of the likes of, say, Damien Chazelle with Whiplash or Jim Cummings who did Thunder Road, and they then did the features off the back of it. Is that a good avenue to take? Or do you feel like, because there's such different genres or approaches to storytelling, those are lightning in a bottle?
It can be. Yeah, I think there is definitely an element of lightning in a bottle with those, because, you know, one of my shorts was, you know, it was meant to be a calling card for a feature about the same thing. But what can often happen with that is that you put everything into a short and then somebody's kind of like, I don't really want to see the feature because I've just seen it. Like Whiplash is a really good example, because there's so much of what's in that feature film that is not in that short. It's got the energy and it's got the tone and it shows off kind of Chazelle's musicality, but it doesn't go into all of that kind of toxicity and who that character is. Like, none of that is really explored in his short. So it makes it really interesting. It just shows that no matter the story, he can deliver on that energy. So yeah, I think it's how you think about that as a calling card short. It needs to open the doors to what you want to do as a feature. But I don't think it always works going, I'm just going to do a mini version of the thing I want to make as a film, because so much of this industry as well is about like, ooh, new, exciting. You know, you want momentum behind what you're doing, and you want it to be like, somebody wants to feel like they're going to see something new. You don't get that if you've had a short before, because you've seen it. So I think do something that showcases your talent as a director, but maybe not a direct relation to your actual feature.
Cool. Awesome. All right. Let's wrap it up. But before we do, I just want to ask quickly about the BFI Insight program, because that was supposed to sort of be happening this year. Obviously, what's happened with that, and is it going to resume? Like, how has that played out?
So it is. We got the news that we had it.
Yeah.
Before lockdown, but a lot of it was to do with kind of weekend residentials, 3 or 4 days, everybody getting together. So that didn't happen. And I'm actually really thankful for the fact that rather than just trying to throw everything online straight away, the team behind it went, let's not do that, because nobody knows what's happening at the moment. And it would have been such a, not a waste, but it would have been really unproductive to then just have an online Zoom with amazing people who are like, I can't tell you anything at the moment because I don't know what's happening. So that's pivoted. There's more things coming online, and you know, the guys putting it together have really tried to adapt it so that it's going to be useful to us now. You know, sort of we're doing a lot more kind of resilience based stuff, which is incredibly useful, the more soft skills stuff to do with producing. So yeah, it's still happening, still exciting. The cohort have all met virtually, which is really good, like saying hello to people. But yeah, I think it'll adapt as we go, which I'm excited about. I think it should do that. So, yeah.
Because this is the inaugural one. This is the first one they've done, right? So they're kind of fighting their feet with you guys as the guinea pigs, I guess, this time around.
Yeah, which is I personally think that's really good, because like I said, they were always going to kind of need to adapt it. But now they can adapt it in real time to what's actually happening. So it's going to be the most useful thing for us. Like I said, there's no point having conversations about how the film industry works. Potentially in the next year or two, it's going to be vastly different. So, yeah, I'd rather we adapt as the world changes at an incredible pace at the moment.
Yeah, so. How are you seeing it? Obviously, I think a lot of people were really in the dark about a month ago. Now it's like there's a little bit of light and sort of idea of what's maybe happening. And that's going to change, as you say, probably umpteen times. But as it stands today, what's the current lie of the land from how you're seeing it, some of the chats you've been having recently?
I think the biggest thing right now is how do we restart production? You know, a lot of those conversations are about, well, what are the safety protocols? What can and can't we do? How can we realistically do that? You know, there was a lot of talk about when, you know, these guidelines came out like sort of 4 weeks ago, that so much of it was just not possible. You know, you can't have, you know, does it just wipe out a romantic comedy because you can't have two lead actors kiss on screen? You know, how does that work in a confined space? Like, what about if you're like, a lot of it is just not feasible, at least on smaller productions, like the quarantining your cast and crew for 2 weeks. If I've got a short that is 2 day shoot, I can't afford to quarantine like 25, 30 people for 2 weeks. You know, it's not going to happen. So yeah, there's a lot of conversations about that. Obviously, there's still insurance, like no insurer is going to cover COVID. I think some productions are starting up with the insurance they had beforehand, so they have that cover, but a lot of them don't. And it's just how that happens realistically. A lot of things are back up and going again, some of those more reality-based stuff that can just send a one-person shooting team out. And I do know there's some more narrative stuff that's going to be starting soon, but I think it's more in the TV landscape. Because again, there's so many kind of nitty-gritty bits of that, of, well, where does the money come from for the overages from COVID support? Does that come from the commissioner's budget? Does it come from recouping from sales? Like, there's a lot of those. We're now getting into the small detail of it, whereas a month or two ago it was about, okay, how do we keep people 2 meters apart? Now it's who's paying for it, how are they paying for it, where's it coming from? So yeah, in the immediacy, that's what everybody's looking at. But it's going to be interesting to see over the next year, or so, the knock-on effect of, like, with sales agents who've had, like, a six-month gap of no content, what are they going to do? Like, how is this going to adapt? Are we going to see a bigger rise in reality TV because it's a quick turnaround? There's so many things that are still unknown. It's going to change a lot of the landscape, I think. Some in exciting ways, some not so much. Personally, I really hope that independent films are given a better shot finding their audience online, that VOD isn't a dirty word, whereas it maybe was before. Like, everybody wants the cinematic experience, but it's not always possible. And I think people were maybe excluded for some really good films so that a director could have a big screen to show their film on. So I'm hoping it already has smashed some of the windows between getting something from screen to an at-home audience. So I'm hoping that continues and more people in remote locations that don't have access to small indie cinemas like me get to see these films when they come out. So yeah, there's lots that's going to change and hopefully some of it for the better.
Yeah, and lots of stuff we don't even know about yet. That's the thing. It's this weird ride that I think we're all on a little bit. But I think we all know that we need the stories and the storytelling to happen come what may. And yeah, to your point, I think the organic sort of indie filmmakers are the ones that can really fill some of that void when it comes to the need for content. And also, I guess, yeah, giving them access that maybe they didn't have before, because the studio films and the Marvels aren't going anywhere. They've got the budgets. They're fine. But, you know, we're running out of content to watch in lockdown on Netflix. People have completed Netflix by now. We need new stuff for people to find to watch.
Yeah, and I think, you know, out of all of these kind of things, I think there's going to be some really, really interesting stories in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Like, you just look at any kind of natural disaster in the world and the kind of stories it can bring about and this kind of change in the way that we look at stories, like the kind of film and media presence we've had since like 9/11 has been huge. Like, in the next 2 or 3 years, how we process this time as a collective, because it's not just the pandemic, there's so much else going on. Like, there's going to be some really interesting voices, there's going to be really important things being said, and there's going to be some stories that just resonate so much with so many people. Like, I think 2 or 3 years is going to be a massive boom of some really excellent, excellent films.
Something to look forward to. Awesome. Yeah. Well, listen, Lucy, I wrap this up on sort of a bit of a lighter note. Do you ever watch Inside the Actor's Studio? You know that show with James Lipton?
Yeah.
You know how at the end he asked people 10 questions?
Okay. Yeah.
You see where I'm going with this?
I do, yes. Okay.
So we'll do quick fire 10 questions that James Lipton used to ask, and just whatever your instinct is, whatever comes up, see what the answer will be. So the first question is, what is your favorite word?
I don't think I can say it because it's a very dirty, dirty word, but I thoroughly enjoy saying it because it's so taboo. So I'll just say that.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, what's your second favorite word that you can say that's not vulgar?
Bivouac. I really like the word bivouac.
Okay. I'm going to have to Google that one later. What's your least favorite word?
Ooh, I don't know. Voice. That's a word I really hate in the industry at the moment.
Okay, I see where you're coming from. Okay. Next question is, what turns you on in a spiritual, creative, intellectual kind of way?
Being alone in nature. Getting away from the world. Yeah. And being in like some woodlands where everything's quiet, that I absolutely love it.
And what turns you off the opposite, being in a crowded city?
Networking in a place where I don't know anybody.
Yes, yeah. That awkward moment where everybody's kind of best friends and you're the one at the bar going, this is like high school all over again.
Yeah, hate it. Absolutely hate it.
The fifth one I'll make optional because it's what's your favorite swear word, but if you want to bypass it, because,
Answered it on number one, I think.
Okay, yeah. All right. People are going to be filling in the blanks and going, what was number one? Number, whatever question we're on now is, what is your favorite sound or noise? Was that it? Was that the sound or noise?
I think it's when my dog is really happy and he makes like a happy squeal. It just fills me with joy. Oh,
awesome. What's your least favorite sound or noise?
That nails on the chalkboard fork plate. Oh, no, don't like it. No.
Almost there. So the last few, if you could do any other job or profession than what you currently do or have done, what would that be?
Some kind of painter, artisty kind of thing, probably.
Creative.
Yeah, definitely.
And what job would you never want to do under any circumstances?
Working with children. Okay. Not good at it. I don't think they like me. We wouldn't get on. So no.
Is that because you have your producer hat on and kids are just like, I don't want these rules and regulations. Let me be free. And
they make no sense. And it boggles my mind. Like, there's no logic to what they do and I can't figure them out. And I'm just like, no.
Excellent. I love that. Okay. Final question is a little bit more ethereal, I guess. And it's, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? What impact do you want to have had?
Somebody that was all right and tried to help people and was happy, I guess.
Awesome. Well, look, Lucy, I guess last minute over to you just to kind of round it off with any final words of advice for anybody watching or listening, and maybe shout about any projects or anything that you want to plug and where people can find you. Floor is yours to kind of take it away.
I just hope that a lot of people have been able to glean something useful from this. One of the best things I found working in this industry is finding people that you connect with, that you love to work with, and who will champion you for what you do. If somebody doesn't champion you, they're probably not worth working with, even if they're the most experienced person in the world. Like, you need to be each other's support network. It's quite a lonely and scary and stressful industry. So find people who support you and equally support other people in the same way, because a rising tide lifts all ships and you all go up together. So be excellent to each other, yes, is what I would say. Keep an eye out for festivals over the next year. Pop should be hopefully going to some festivals. If we do well, fingers crossed, BAFTA time, I can only hope. Just keep an eye out for Pop and keep doing what you're doing, and I wish everybody the best.